Corporal Wiki.
Who was Corporal Wiki?
Yes, that is correct. You know, take it for 400 now. Yeah, I like that guy. I like his voice. Mm-hmm. What I did was, if you cleanly copy an HTML table out of a page, you can drop it into Google Docs and all the text will be in. So I'm looking at the list of the dramatis personae. So, because I always forget names of things.
I'm so bad with the character names in this movie. So I'm going to be referring to Brad Pitt and Christoph Waltz.
Oh, man. There's so many actors in here, too.
There's a lot.
Oh,
yeah.
What a cast.
Yeah. All of them really good. I mean, there are a couple little surprises where you're just like, really? Mike Myers is in this?
Oh, I'll get to that.
Some people found him distracting. I'm interested to hear what you think of that.
Mm-hmm. Did anyone do a Twitter poll on that or anything? I don't even remember what the results were.
that was you.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, I think of you as the box office mojo guy.
Oh. I wear many hats.
You do. You're so cute. This is nice. Mm-hmm. You know, Todd showed me the Carpenter's Cup.
Did he really?
Yeah, it was pretty baller. He's like, hey, over here's the cafeteria. Oh, by the way, check that out.
God, Jesus Christ, no big deal.
Oh my God. Of course I took a photo of it like a dork. Show my daughter as the Carpenter's Cup.
You have that on a hair trigger. We were talking about it the other day and you're like, you mean this?
Oh, geez, man. Well, just wait till all my data syncs up between my devices and I won't have to just always go to the same device. No, that was great. It's pretty epic to visit with you there. It's pretty, pretty epic.
My pleasure.
How are you guys doing? You guys are on an Indiana Jones tear right now.
Yeah. We for some reason were like, you know, that seems like a good idea. And then we were like, you know, it's two bad ones and two good ones. So what are you going to do? Mix it up.
I've never shown my daughter Temple of Doom because it, like, for all the reasons you guys said. I mean, you guys really nailed it. It's, I don't know. You probably can't say, Todd. Did you work on that? Did you make anything for that? Did you, the Asian boy?
I worked on Indy 4. Hey, the Asian boy. Come on. I was 10.
There is no Indy 4, silly. You think of that Dan Aykroyd skull vodka.
Hold on. Are we live?
Yes.
We're live. Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Hello? The clock there?
You talk all you want about Indiana Jones. I'll be sipping my beverage.
Oh.
I enjoy the work of Steven Spielberg. He's a good director in most instances.
He did that movie Tantan.
Oh my God. That's right. He did do that, didn't he?
Love that Tantan.
From the director of Always.
Did you know that Simon Pegg was going to be in this, but he went and did Tintin instead?
Mm-hmm. I did. Did you know that BJ Novak had to take time off from the office to do this?
No, I didn't.
So you're telling me that was not Chris Sacca in this movie?
Wow. Huh. Did you know that Quentin Tarantino was considering abandoning the film while the casting search for someone to play Colonel Hans Landa took place, fearing he'd written a role that was unplayable?
Kind of almost did. Come on. I mean, well.
Can you imagine anybody, save it for the show, but I mean, anybody else in that role?
That was perfect.
It's
Todd
impossible. Said
it. Todd nailed it, man. It's his movie and everybody else is in support. I mean, it's just, all right.
I guess should we try and attempt to put some sort of like pseudo official introduction to this episode?
I don't normally do that. You keep asking the guests. Yes.
Yeah. Go, Dan, go do the thing.
Positive. Yes.
You can talk.
Oh, God. So, for the first time in the history of our podcast, after almost 2.5 years, we have two guests on our show. We have Merlin Mann and Todd Vaziri, former guest, who was on our longest episode in history, where I basically blacked out and got yelled at by both of you guys.
Yeah.
Well, welcome both of you to the show.
Thank you.
That was way too radio voicey. I apologize for that.
That's super.
Glad to be here.
So nice to be here. I'm a fan. I listen to you guys in the Shamus.com. Member feed, if you know what I mean. And I really enjoy your show and I like you as people. It's very nice to be here.
Oh, thank you. It's great to have the inventor of follow up on here.
And Todd, we got to get Todd out of the garage more often, don't you think?
Yeah, Todd,
he works in the sub basement.
Todd went on Oral Nuts and gave them like his history of how he came to be as a human being. So good. Yeah, I like that one. That was a good episode with Todd.
He talked about his work over at Industrial Lights and Magic.
Mm-hmm. How much did they pay for that exclusive interview, Todd? How come we didn't get a shot at that?
You guys got to shovel out the big bucks. Come on.
Anyway, so yes, we are here today to discuss Inglourious Basterds. Why did we pick this up? Because didn't Marlene just start tweeting a bunch of GIFs while you were watching this a couple of weeks ago?
I think it was one of those strange emotional public hysterias where like several of us were kind of watching it around the same time.
Yeah.
And concomitant, at least in my memory with that, was, hey, you know, we should do an episode with us for dorks. And then we like debated just a little bit about what to watch. And this seemed like a pretty good one.
Have you guys done Tarantino movies before here?
Yeah. I would say I'm not a huge Tarantino fan, so I'm usually reluctant. This is actually the first time I've ever seen Inglourious Basterds for this moment, for this.
Delicious.
Yeah, because I don't know. I find him, especially the later stuff, to be kind of self-indulgent and he can't really edit himself. and it gets kind of rambly and weird. But, you know, I will say this is probably my favorite thing that he has done recently. And by recently, I mean, you know, a decade or so. But yeah, I thought this was pretty good. I like it better than I liked Django Unchained. Although that was not as terrible as I had feared. It's just mostly the third act is just all over the place.
Mm-hmm. Are you mostly, do you have a general stance on movies that wink and are sort of self-aware? Do you have is that something that just bugs you in general?
No, I like it sometimes. It's really delicate balance to try to strike, because if you're winking at the audience, like it's sort of like trying to make the perfect joke or something. It's like I can't really describe like when it's annoying or when it's funny. But yeah, it's a really difficult line to cross. And I know that a lot of people really look forward to Tarantino for his sort of winking and nodding and meta movie-ness.
Do you generally not want to be reminded that you're watching a movie? Yeah, like you don't want to be reminded of context? Like, hey, you know, you're watching us, watching you, watching us, watching you. Is that a big thing, like breaking the fourth wall, or just too self-aware? Is it self-awareness that sometimes bugs you, or
no,
what is it?
I'm struggling to think of any particular reason, any particular example that comes to mind. And for some reason,
maybe something like Wes Anderson in a similar way. I think it seems like everybody has some Wes Anderson movies they like, and even fairly ardent fans have some where they go, okay, that was a little bit of an Anderson too far, you know, because there are these certain directors, every director's got their ticks. But I mean, it's just that Tarantino, amongst others, I guess maybe Charlie Kaufman, but you know, there are a lot of directors that kind of revel in their ticks, and that's a big part of their appeal. I would say in that way, like, you know, I'm just an unabashed Edgar Wright fan. But if you don't like Edgar Wright movies, you're not going to like an Edgar Wright movie. Is it that kind of thing?
I would say so. It's a reluctance to go 100% on the journey with him when he's like, here's my 70s grindhouse. I was in a theater store. I'm sorry, a video rental job forever, mm-hmm, kind mm-hmm. of nerdy stuff. Like some of that he gets a little hung up on, and it pushes me away from the film. Not necessarily that I don't want to be reminded that I'm watching a film, or that you know, it's over the top or anything. That the over the topness in and of itself is not bothersome. Like the violence being unrealistic or depicted in a extremely grotesque or voyeuristic way doesn't bother me a lot, but it can if it feels like it's the only trick the movie has. And I think the reason why I like Inglourious Basterds more than perhaps some of the other things is because I feel like there's a lot of stuff that's happening in this film that has absolutely nothing to do with some of the hangups I would usually ascribe to him. Mm-hmm. It's just great tension and dialogue in just like these scenes around tables in this film. There's so many scenes around tables. I don't know what Quentin Tarantino has against tables.
Wow.
But yeah.
I never thought of that, but like we criticize some directors for excruciating plots that involve lots of meetings, but you're right. Mm-hmm. You're right. It's interesting. Like there's two of the really, I'm sure we'll talk about this, two of the really outstanding, I mean, the scenes that I just keep thinking about over and over basically involve people in a room with the threat of danger. Mm-hmm. Mostly, and then just this veneer of civility that you're waiting to break for some reason.
Yeah, and you see it right from the get-go with the first scene with Christoph Waltz and the French dairy farmer guy. That whole thing's just painful because you know it's not going to go well the whole entire time you're watching it happen, and it is really tense to watch that unfold. Not to mention later on the scene with Shoshana, which is dreadful. You just feel awful for her the whole entire time. You're just like, is this the moment where she gets found out or not? And even scenes that don't involve Christoph Waltz, you have the scene with Michael Fassbender and the other unlucky people down in the basement going through their charade to try to get Bridget von Hammersmark out of there. And it's that watching that all happen inside of this film is just really interesting in that I feel like it challenges you in a way that the violence in this film doesn't really seem that challenging in any way. It's just, you know, people get shot and scalped and stuff and carved and things. I don't come away from the movie thinking about that stuff. I come away from the movie thinking about just like sitting there around a table, tense, watching these characters try to navigate these conversations without springing the trap. And that's I think, really the best part of this film.
So I don't have an opening statement, but I guess this is probably a good time for it. I'm a fan of Tarantino's, but I'm not a diehard fan, like meaning like every single one. I don't think he hits home runs. I think my favorite Tarantino film is probably Reservoir Dogs, and my second favorite is Inglourious Basterds, because there's something about those intermediate films, and I'll include Pulp Fiction, which I think is really magnificent, and in a lot of ways is the film his early career he was born to do. I think it is really tight, but it is. I don't think it holds up very well, and maybe it's just because, you know, his style became, you know, which is an amalgam of many other styles. His style, he called it his own, and other people have been trying to ape it for all this time. So now everybody else has been trying to do Tarantino movies, and you look back at Pulp Fiction, and I think it kind of, you can read it like a book almost. But then I feel like the indulgences got the better of him at least for my taste, in some of the intermediate films like Kill Bill, and particularly, was it Death Proof? Part of Grindhouse?
Yeah.
That was that one. I mean, I don't know. I just was like, okay, I think Tarantino's just going to keep making these kind of films. And for some reason, Inglourious Basterds, I decided to do one of my full media blackouts on it. I really don't know why. Maybe it was the subject matter that I thought, like, wow, he's actually tackling something a little bit different this time. So I did it, and it was very well rewarded. I thought this was like a new chapter for him, a more adult, more mature, and a more restrained version of everything that he's been doing thus far, but on a much deeper level. And some of the motifs and stuff that he accomplished in this film, I think, is you can't really see. It's more of a surprise and when looking at his body of work. And I actually really liked Hateful Eight. I think he's, and particularly Django Unchained, got a little bit more indulgent as well. But I don't know. I just found this to be such a... He's always been a master of tension, but never in the like pure like Hitchcockian way of, you know, there's going to be danger in this room. And the way he sets it up here, it's not just about tough guys like Reservoir Dogs. I found this to be a step above his previous work. And I've only seen it a few times. It's one of those movies that I don't want to overwatch, you know, for fear of like ruining it for myself. But and rewatching it for this, I was like, oh, yeah, this is really good. This is really good.
Yeah, the tension stuff is... Boy, and the more I think about it, and it's not two, there's so many scenes that just involve sitting around a table where there's so much tension. The casting, so great. To a person, almost everybody in this movie is an antihero. you know, in the kind of 70s New Hollywood sense, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, even you take somebody like, obviously take The Bastards, and like what they're doing is, you know, it's very violent and it's very extrajudicial, right? So it's they're not the good guys, even though they're the good guys. And then you look at Londa, and I mean, he's got to be up there with Batman villains and Magneto in terms of being like one of the like great villains, but so charismatic. You find yourself not exactly pulling for him because he's a monster, but his ability to control the situation at any time. And I like, what's the note I wrote here? He's like a, you know, like a cold reader, like somebody who's a medium, somebody who can like talk to you for a couple seconds and immediately get clues to know the next thing to say to you, to the next thing to say to you. Mm-hmm. Like, he knows that everybody has a reason. He knows everybody has done something bad and that they will eventually reveal it to him. And he's so gracious that you're sort of unhinged, you know, by his civility. What an amazing character, but everybody in it is doing something wrong according to somebody. Mm-hmm. Even the farmer is, you know, breaking the law and, you know, and potentially endangering his family. So, I mean, when you put all of that in this big crucible of drama, that is a high bar to cross. And I understand this movie is problematic to a lot of people. I get that. That's fine. Like, I get that. I do get that. Like, I would not substitute a good World War II class by watching this.
Oh, because
it really is. It's basically high budget. It's high budget fan fiction.
It's a comic book.
Right. When you open your blue book, you know, you should probably have a little more facts. But anyway, yeah, I agree with what y'all are saying. I mean, I am a fan of his stuff. I like it a lot. But Todd, what you said about Pulp Fiction, that part of it was that movie was so shocking when it came out. Not shocking in like a, you know, Texas Chainsaw way, but in a, like, it was ripe in that age of irony and postmodernism. It really hit it out of the park at the time for winding up all these different genres and doing the self-awareness and the Royale with Cheese and all of this stuff. Was like, nobody had seen anything quite like this in that mix. And I agree with you. I think Reservoir Dogs ends up feeling like the better movie. I personally like Kill Bill. Don't at me. But wait, I'm with you.
Both parts of Kill Bill or just one part of Kill Bill?
We're in the Ironsides theme. Come on.
I'm with Merlin on the Kill Bill. There's a lot of really good stuff.
I don't want to like it, but you know, I don't like feet as much as Quentin Tarantino. But the man likes feet. But
we'll
I know what you mean.
Feet in this one.
Yeah. Oh my goodness. But yeah.
No, this is this movie in particular. One of the things that I like about it, especially compared to some of his other work, is. He's great at building tension, but it's like he breaks tension by adding more tension in a different way. Like, he's got his, you know, his style is kind of like, look how cinematic, look how much of a movie this is when you've got your slow-mo of the, you know, the Nazi who's about to get beaten to death by Eli Roth or whatever, like his absurdly long slow-mo walk up to before he kneels down. And that is, you know, it's building to something. And then what it builds to is this sort of quiet sit-down scene where you know it's going to end badly. So it's just tension on top of tension. But the thing about this movie that I really only noticed after this viewing is that every character is incredibly smart. Like, there aren't any people who are really getting duped. They all have their own plans and what they're trying to accomplish. And, you know, the way they intermingle with each other is sort of the story of it all. But they're all incredibly smart characters, you know, doing their best, and, you know, some get outsmarted by others, but it's like watching these people compete is just as fun as anything else. And especially these table scenes where they're just sitting there staring at each other. It's like, well, I like all of these guys and they're all great characters and smart people. And it's like, well, who do I want to win this? And it's like, doesn't matter. This is too much fun to watch.
It's funny you mentioned the smart people, because obviously, you know, Waltz is the smartest guy in the movie, but every single person, like, the only slip-ups are almost like coincidental or minor. And I just, you know, there's something about like Michael Mann movies where you see people who are really good at their job doing their job really well. And there's something so attractive about this. And that's what this movie is. Everybody's got some really clever, great ideas, and they're all trying to sneak around the system. And almost in a lot of ways, everybody's got their own little victories. And oh man.
But also nobody has a guarantee of success.
Oh yeah.
Like even the Nazis, excuse me, even the Nazis, you know, who are so well organized and have it all together. Like, you know, it is only we are given to believe it is only through the tireless care of people like those guys in the basement checking for accents and how you count to three. If it weren't for people like that, you know, the war might be over. It's like everybody's got something to lose, and everybody's got something on the line, and pretty much everybody has a vulnerability, which, I mean, I guess that's what makes it a character. But, you know, it's not, unlike in some places, it's not overplayed. And, you know, and when he does hit the Tarantino button in this one, I feel like it works a lot of the time. Mm-hmm. Like normally, you know, cutting away to a, okay, we need the narrator to do VO right now. Well, how great is it that that's Samuel L. Jackson? And then we cut over to this, and like, it's not too long. It's just enough. When they cut to, you know, Stiglitz. It's a Stiglitz up on the screen.
So great.
Or like, you know, just doing call outs. Like he's writing on his iPhone, like going, oh, right over there. That's, you know, Martin Borman or whatever. It doesn't, I feel like it doesn't go too far. It didn't try my patience, and it seemed to know where the bounds of the cheekiness should be.
Yeah, like,
but, you know, you think about that scene, like, in Pulp Fiction, like, I mean, anybody who saw that in the theater, like, you know, I was, what, 25 when that came out? 20, 35? I don't even remember. I was in my 20s. But the scene where they're eating the Kahuna Burgers, and the two guys come in, and Brett and his friends are in there, and Samuel L. Jackson just shoots the guy. And he's like, I'm sorry, did I break your concentration? It's like, that did not make this less tense. That made that 100 times more tense. Like, this is not going to end well for anybody. That's, you know, and in this case, I think he applied that well.
Yeah, and probably at the time for Pulp Fiction, there were a lot of people who saw that and said, that's not how movies work. You don't do that. What are you doing? Mm-hmm. And then it throws you so far out of your comfort zone. And that's the thing about this movie. Like, it is so absurdly fictional, but... it buys into itself 100% of just like we're gonna be a movie about World War II. We're gonna have Hitler in it. We're gonna do all kinds of horrible, brutal stuff. Like, the one image that I can never get out of my head in this, like, aside from all the tension, and you talk about some of the brutality, and it's like, yeah, there are a lot of brutal World War II movies that, you know, spend a lot of time on some of the brutality, but the image of Stiglitz stabbing his knife into the back of that major's head in the table repeatedly, it's like, what in God's name am I watching right now? And it's like, that's this world we're living. It's like, it's just, there's the brutality right there. But it's so comic booky in those instances. And then you've got these incredible performances and tension around the tables to punctuate it, to make it all feel so real. It's just such an amazing exploration in just like cinema that it's, yeah. That's why it all works. Like, the story is nonsense. Every little bit of it is insane. And the idea that all of these things are going to come together, it's nonsense, but it's so much fun.
And film, I mean, not to jump too far ahead, but, you know, the thing on really every watch of this, but especially as you watch it more and more, film itself is a character in this. Literal film is a character in this. Film culture is I mean, and just all the way down to, like, there's so many aspects that, you know, somebody who enjoys movies, enjoys cinema as a genre and as a, like, an occupation, there's so much in this to enjoy, from the sly and the arch to the incredibly over the top, as in, like, a pile of film behind a screen is going to be like the major turning point in this movie.
Yeah. And the music cue for that is just ridiculous. He walks back there, you just get that slow reveal of this glistening nitrate film. But it also factors in terms of her running the cinema and their conversations about which directors, and how that also plays into Fassbender's weird his situation.
His German, but also his, like, his nerdiness. Like, it's the reason they chose him is because he's a film nerd. You know, he knows who Pabst is. You know, he knows all those things. And, you know, it's like any kind of thing where, like, I get to be the superhero because I know Wolverine's real name or something like that. It's, yeah, I thought that was pretty great.
Yeah. And I will say, in terms of tension and ratcheting it up and releasing tension and Fassbender, that scene with the basement... the way that unfolded, it became a situation where it kept going one thing after another thing, all the characters in the room being as smart as they could be to try and push things around and watch these little chess pieces move. And you'd see his whole reason for going on this mission completely fail. him. Mm-hmm. His nerdiness, his book smarts, couldn't pay off when it finally came down to it. And he got the chance to play a little of that in his favor when he cited the specific Pabst movie and the town, etc. But he ultimately couldn't save him and accomplish what he wanted
so
to do.
So close. So close.
This is the first time you've seen that scene. How did that scene hit you, since you weren't spoiled with the three finger thing there?
Oh, man, that scene is nuts. What I really like about that is I didn't know which way it was going to go. Mm-hmm. Usually in a lot of these scenes, like especially at the beginning with Christoph Waltz, and you know that the people underneath the floorboards are going to die. And when you get to the scene in the basement, you're like, well, something bad is going to happen, or they're going to get away scot-free, and they'll be like, oh, man, that was so tense.
It's a Tarantino movie.
Yeah, no, this wow, it, just the way it, but the way it went out of control, too, I think is really interesting, because they set it up with the conversation ahead of time that Stieglitz will remain calm, that Fassbender's worried about him blowing the cover, about him messing things up, and it's Fassbender who's impatient and causes the situation, which calls attention to himself by the other officer in the back room they didn't know about.
This is just totally in my head canon, but like, you think they're going to pull it off. It seems like, okay, he's going to be able to dial this thing down. And for some reason, that one shot, that one moment reminds me of Dr. Strangelove, one of my favorite movies. And there's that moment when President Muffley turns and says, "What do you think, Dr. Strangelove?" And you're like, "What? What is he? What?" And suddenly, moment, my Fuhrer. Like he spins around, and in that case, a different German guy. But there's that moment where he pops up out of his seat, and it's like, "Oh shit! I thought we were clear. I thought we were in the clear. And now this guy's gonna come in. He's got total eye of the tiger, and he's gonna totally spoil this." Such a great scene.
What is Fassbender's first mistake was the, or not mistake, but he was, the first suspicion was his accent, right? It was the one enlisted soldier that questioned his accent.
Yeah, drunken Wilhelm was getting an autograph for his newborn son.
Can we talk about accents and language for a second? Because
sure.
I don't think I've ever seen a movie where one of the motifs is languages and being bilingual and playing with the audience's expectation or even knowledge of certain languages. So this is a movie that ostensibly for English audiences, right? Because you have certain scenes where, okay, so the first scene at the dairy farm, you've got the bilingual aspect there where Waltz comes in speaking French, right? And he switches to English, right? And to hide his actual intentions from anybody who might be listening. You've got in later scenes,
the Italian, the fake, you got the fake Italian accents.
Third
best.
Well,
you've got them in a,
it was very
in a pickle.
Subtle scene.
You've got them in a pickle because we can't get them in. Okay, what languages do you Americans possibly know? Oh, I know a little bit of Italian. Okay, so that's what we got to work on. You're a little bit of Italian.
And Germans don't have a good ear for Italian. So there's levels and levels to it.
In the restaurant scene, there's a lot of German that's being spoke without subtitles. So we're in with Shoshana. Maybe she doesn't necessarily know what's going on at that time.
And when there's the French translator, it's all going through the translator that he's banging. Right.
So, I mean, I just found it fascinating. I don't think I've ever seen a movie like this where the knowledge or lack of knowledge of a certain language, not only for the characters, but for the audience, plays such a big role. And then for it to be, you know, kind of a subplot type thing, and then be propelled into the actual plot. Like, we can't get in you guys into this theater if you don't know German or if you don't know French. I found that to be, you know, remarkable. And then on the second viewing, if you look really carefully at the characters who may or may not know a language, or when subtitles are on or off, it adds to a whole new layer. And I also wonder how this plays in other territories. You know, how does this play in Japan or frankly Italy or France or Germany? How they get around that fact, because you can't, you know, the simple dubbing of these languages won't necessarily work for these scenes. But I don't know. Find it fascinating.
This is so interesting, because it's funny, because I'd written down this note about authenticity and identity and like the kind of the layers of like who you are, like not just what you represent, like what your name is. There's all these things. There's so much signification about identity in this. And but you put it even better. I mean, the language thing really nails it. According to IMDb, I have not vetted this. I would not have guessed this. According to IMDb, which is never wrong, only 30% of the dialogue in the movie is in English, which I would not in 100 years have guessed.
Yeah,
because I get fatigue. I get fatigue. I mean, I like me some French New Wave, but you know, you can only do so much. You know, you just want to unwind and, you know, watch some Stranger Things. But in this case, I felt no fatigue at all from this. And isn't that odd? 30% is in English.
Well, that's because I think that a lot of that has to do with how it's broken up. The pacing of this changes. It goes back to English. It goes from French to German and back again. Mm-hmm. And you cut away from different parties of characters speaking to one another. So that can make it seem less monotonous in a filmmaking sense. There isn't like it is literally 30% of this film chronologically that's in English. And that way you don't feel like you're watching Avatar and you're reading like papyrus subtitles. But yeah, it is this...
Todd just got punched in the stomach.
Title.
Yep. Got some heartburn here.
I definitely agree with Todd that the language plays such a huge role in this. And one of the things I really like about it is how smart he is with the language as a director in using it to shape the conversations that the characters are having. Like when he switches to English in the first scene, and you think that that's the usual trope of I've written all of the German that I think an American audience can endure. I will switch to English now.
You do like a Hunt for Red October
exactly,
on them.
Exactly, zoom into the mouth thing. Yeah. Okay, we're in English the rest of the time. I mean, this is going to be just like every other Hollywood movie set in Germany or wherever. We're just going to be speaking English, strangely enough, with British accents. Nope, they're just messing with you right there.
Yeah, no Tom Cruise showing up in this one, but like the most complex version of that you would see in a lesser Hollywood movie would be like two characters in one scene speaking a different language in front of somebody that they didn't think that person also knew the language is like, aha, but I also understand what you were saying, so your plan to double cross me has been thwarted. It's like that is like as far as most people take language in cinema. And this one, yeah, he's all over the map. I mean, just the people who are good at speaking, people who are terrible at speaking, like, you know, Brad Pitt's horrible Italian is hilarious, but it's also a huge, like, it's a showdown between him and Christoph
Landa.
Waltz in that scene there. Yeah, Landa.
Gorlami.
Exactly. It's like, you know you're thwarted, but you got to keep going anyway because you both are going to fight as hard as you can.
And his civility is what nails that to the floor, is that in the scene, the wonderful opening scene, which I think is just, it feels like a masterclass to me. But, you know, if he had gone in there and been some kind of like Frank Burns character who was really that's a reference to a show from the 70s. But if he'd been some kind of like really over the top, like manic character, on the one hand, the French guy would have felt no need to hold his composure and the people under the boards would have gotten clued to the fact that something was going on. All they hear is two people speaking in a very civil way in very quiet tones. It doesn't sound like anything terrible. They're sitting around drinking milk. Like it's all good. All good. And now just next step over, we hop to how his civility has a role in totally undoing all of the people that he talks to, because he's so put together. He's so not bothered. And you never know what he knows. And I think that the language just becomes another layer that obscures. Does he really, I mean, does he know? Does he know? Because he seems like he knows. I think he knows.
Yeah, the one thing I wasn't sure about is in, you know, the strudel cafe scene.
Oh, mm-hmm. I sure do.
Oh yeah, and when he orders that glass of milk,
I know.
Wait for the cream. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay,
and so can we talk about the milk? I mean,
yes.
So did he miss his chance? I mean, he it's on the tip of his tongue. He thinks he recognizes her.
Oh, he just had one more thing to ask her.
Can't remember. Must not have been important, right? I mean. Are we seeing a neural net of his brain at that moment when he orders her the milk? You know what I mean?
I read three different Stack Exchange responses to whether the milk was deliberate.
Oh, you got to go deep in the stack.
In my popping the stack, I think, I mean, in my head, like, I think he does know, but he's also, he's kind of like, he's a real deep intel kind of guy. Like I said earlier, you know, there's like that famous quote from Benjamin Franklin about how you should hit your children every day because if you don't know what it's for, they will. Like, he knows everybody has a secret, and he knows everybody has, like, making everybody fearful and respectful of him benefits him. And he has this ability to telegraph that he knows things without sounding like a dick, which makes it even more disarming. So my vote, and I don't know, I'd love to hear what you guys think. My vote is that maybe he did know, and if he is the deep intel guy that I think, he probably thought, I have nothing to lose by stringing this girl along further, making her more scared. Maybe nothing will happen now that I've done this, and we won't have to have any bloodshed. Maybe, but in any case, if you're somebody who is an intelligent person, it benefits you for people to not understand your methods and your operations, let alone the content of what you know. And so I don't know. What do you guys think? Was the milk a thing?
Yeah, I'm not sure, after this being my only viewing, I'm not sure where I come down on that. I do kind of agree that I think it might be a thing where he is expressly communicating that he knows something, but he's not going to act on it. But he can. It is a weird thing to just order someone milk. And that's the only reason why I can come back to that over and over again, because it's not like he favors milk and he always wants to have milk. He wanted milk in that first scene because it was a dairy farm, and he wanted to talk about other dairy farmers. And then he wanted to have espresso that he ordered for himself. So it's not like he's constantly craving milk left and right. He just specifically orders it for her. So that makes me deeply suspicious that of course he seemed to know.
I think it works both ways. I think like the ordering the milk for her or any drink for her is like a show of force and of intimidation. He's trying to get control of the situation. He's in charge of security for this premiere. I could see it that way. And like, maybe he was onto something, you know, he's squinting at her. Can't for the life of him think about it. I can take that at face value. Or he knows that it's Shoshana and he's going to use her as a useful tool because he wants this thing to go off without a hitch. And if she's scared, maybe that's useful to him. I don't know. I think it works fine.
You're saying
way.
It could just be a try the meatloaf moment.
Yeah.
Like it's just a power move. Yeah.
I don't think it's necessary to actually think this through to enjoy the scene in the movie, but I think it's pretty definitive that he does know, particularly because, yeah, it is a power move, but the milk is a weird choice. And given that he like didn't even attempt to shoot her when she was running out of the house, I think he's got a little bit of a sadistic side for, you know, maybe it's just for young Jewish women that he's just like, whatever, I'll catch you later. Like, you're not going to do anything. Like, you're not a problem. And that stare down at the end there when he says, I can't remember what it was. Of course, he can remember exactly what he wants to say to her. And he's just letting her know that I know everything that's going on with you. But I think it might be the attempted, we're supposed to read into the subtext that, like, if he outs her right there, she's dead. And that screws up the whole premiere. And then Goebbels is going to be all angry and everyone's going to have to change their plans. And, you know, the higher ups are going to be really annoyed. But it's going to be him doing his job. So he's basically looking her in the eye and saying, I know who you are. I'm going to get you. I'm going to kill you at some point. Don't worry about that because I'm real good at my job, clearly. But you're going to do this thing that they want you to do and host our premiere, and then we'll figure it out from there.
He also does this thing several times where he dangles a very serious threat without stating it. Well, he's sort of like, that's the subtext for, or the context for what he's saying is always that there's the potential here for this to go really badly for you. Like, I'm very civil. I'm going to drink your milk. There's always, he doesn't even need to say it. Like, this could go very, very wrong for you. But then he also dangles, and this is such a power move. He always dangles the chance that he Columbos them a little bit with this, like, sense that there could be resolution here. Listen, I want to close this case about your family. Mm-hmm. We just need to answer a couple more mm-hmm. questions. And just like when Shoshana's sitting there, you know, she's just thinking, as we know, when he finally does leave, like she's, you know, gasping for air because she was so on edge that whole time. And he's dangling it out there. Like, obviously she knows who he is. The whole time she's thinking, I'm clocked.
Yeah.
He totally knows. Like, he yelled at me when I was running away and shooting and like, oh, I'll see you later, Shoshana. Like, I think that was heavily telegraphed. But like, that's part of what he does also, is that it's kind of like somebody who says, they text you, we need to talk, and then don't text you back for 3 hours. It's like, is there any greater sadist in the world? Who says that to a person?
Well, I guess, and with him,
get out of here.
if we're talking around a table in public, that's one thing. But if we're talking in private upstairs at the cinema, it could go very badly very quickly, mm-hmm. in which case you just get choked to death on the floor real fast, which is bad. I mean, it was great that we saw that part of his personality.
Oh, when her hand goes into the jacket and just like, what a, oh, that expression
stops moving in our face. Yeah, but like, even at the end there, I think he's trying to bring it back to sort of say, like, when Christoph is kind of annoyed that Brad Pitt doesn't assume that he's as smart as he really is, you know, like, of course I recognize all your guys, like, that's my job. I think that's again sort of telegraphing that, sure, maybe I'm sort of, he's not necessarily playing dumb, but he's not showing his hand before he has to with anybody, because he's saving that right up until the last moment where he could possibly need it. And then it's like, nope, now I'm going to play my trump card and you're all dead.
Yeah. Well, like with Bridget Hammersmark, he already had the napkin with her autograph, and there was a missing woman from that scene. So he could have just, you know, immediately grabbed her.
He could have sent somebody else to go pick her up.
Yeah.
I mean, the evidence was all there. There was no real need to do that.
No, and certainly not a reason to play along with the mountain climbing story, which entertained him, or the
which mountain in Paris,
or converse with Brad Pitt and go along with the whole farce that they knew Italian.
He's so many steps ahead that he's just like, he's playing with like a wounded rat, and he's like, I'm gonna eat you here just a little bit, but we're gonna have a little bit of fun just for now.
All leading up to a lot of shots of her feet.
Yeah, a lot of feet.
And her shoe. And mm-hmm. in the even in the tavern in the basement, there's a couple, I think there's only one like quick cutaway to her when she rises, of a close up of her feet just kind of shuffling, you know, to kind of plant that seed. And then,
people have feet, Todd. What's the big deal? People have feet.
Yeah. Why cut to a close up of feet? Yeah, exactly.
I mean, why cut to a close-up of, like, putting the cream on both of the strudels? Like, those are the shots that are, like, gratuitous Tarantino style.
How would we know if Uma Thurman is coming out of her stupor unless we look at her toes?
Move your big toe.
Look at the toes. Look at them. Look at that big toe.
Okay, back on Christoph Waltz for 1 second about language. Okay, so he's definitely the superstar of this movie, right? I mean, can you imagine anybody else playing him? Who now, which came first? Was this written just for him? Because you need to have not only an amazing actor who can do all of these things, but speak German, right, English, French, and Italian.
Todd, would you like to guess who the first choice was? I'll give you a hint. Also in Django Unchained, who was the first choice for Londo?
Will he ever let go? Will his heart go on?
His heart will go on. Draw me like your French girls.
Can you imagine Leonardo DiCaprio in that role?
I absolutely cannot.
See, I think that's the much more traditional Hollywood casting choice, right. And sure. I do not like that idea.
I think DiCaprio could do a pretty good stare down, but I don't think he could fill the rest of the
role. I could see, like, you know, in terms of like, you know, creepy clown with a dungeon vibe, like I could totally see like Kevin Spacey, maybe, mm-hmm. if he had the language.
Yeah. Like somebody younger, Jeremy Irons, perhaps.
Oh, Jeremy Irons. That's good. Mm-hmm. But Kevin Spacey, he's got a clown dungeon vibe.
As written like this, as performed in the final movie, I mean, to have that kind of mastery over language and to not be ridiculous, I don't know. There's probably a dozen people in the world that could have played this part.
It would be like, you know, let's do Citizen Kane with John Garfield. Like, you know, he's really good. He's a great actor, but like it wouldn't have been the same movie.
Yep. What else? I mean, we got one of the biggest stars in the world, Brad Pitt, as this character. I mean,
how did
you guys feel about that? Was it off-putting? Was it distracting, especially when you've got a lot of other actors that you haven't really seen in a lot of movies, like Christoph Waltz and at the time Michael Fassbender. What did you guys think of Brad Pitt's performance?
I think Brad Pitt was kind of a distracting cartoon, a little bit. Tiny bit.
Shut your mouth.
He's a mountain man with like a 15 inch knife in his side.
God, he's part Apache. It's very problematic. Goodness, Joe.
He's been chewed out before.
Oh, I love that line. I was going to make it my Twitter bio.
Oh my gosh.
I have that as a gift that I've been waiting to use to reply to somebody. I've never had the opportunity.
This
is threatening to push out Parks and Recreation in my GIF wrapped app. Like, there's so many brilliant GIFs. All right. Let's hear it out. Air your grievance. Let's hear it.
Sigh. There are these moments where it feels like he might be in a different film. than Christoph Waltz
is. True. But maybe a local community theater thing.
But I mean, it's not that he's doing a bad job at what he's supposed to be doing, because that is that character. Maybe it's just the fact that there's this sort of buffoonish, rough around the edges Tennessee mountain guy that just doesn't feel like it seamlessly fits in with everything else, but he's okay. I mean, I'm not saying
he's a good, but he's a good balance to the seriousness of all the other guys. Like, I was just reading, as you might know, I've spent the evening reading IMDb trivia about this. Apparently, turns out, Stiglitz is like the most popular actor in Germany. Did you know that?
Yeah, he was also in that Aliens movie.
He refused to play Nazis in any role that was given to him except this one because he got to kill Nazis.
That's right.
Yeah. No, I think the...
I guess everybody can get the internet now. This is weird.
Yeah, it's all over the place. We got it streaming in.
I had so many insights in Bonds Mott, but apparently everybody can read this now.
No, it's just... we can't steal insights, man.
But I agree with you. It is very cartoonish. I mean, there are several characters in this that are... as you say, in a different movie, maybe including Mike Myers. I liked him, but in that instance, I like that he, you know, at some point I got a note here. I want to talk about the mashup of genres in this.
I want to build on that if you got a moment, or do you want to finish your thought?
No, I just I was going to say was like one of the many genres that gets mashed up into this is, I don't know what you call this, but I'll call it the Dirty Dozen type movie. Like one of those, like we go, you know, Force 10 from Nevron, whatever, you know, there's a Magnificent Seven, maybe Seven Samurai, but like there's this, like, we're going to get a posse together and do some stuff. And I feel like starting with Dirty Dozen, like that became a genre that maybe isn't the first one of those, but that whole like ragtag group who's going to go out on a suicide mission is such to me, like for me and my pal John Roderick, that's like one of my favorite genres. I love that genre of film, but I like that he's in a different movie in that case.
Yeah.
You know, I like that there's so much seriousness to all of the other bastards, mostly, except for when like they want to do the madman thing. But like, you know, by and large, they're all extremely serious. And I like that that's leavened with his malaprops and crazy talk and silly mustache. But I take your point, Joe. He is kind of in a different movie.
It's nothing bad about him, though. I mean, he's doing what he's supposed to be doing here. I don't want people to like write back, why do you hate Brad Pitt?
They've adopted a lot of children, Joe. They've helped a lot of people.
Yeah. No, he's in his Magnificent Seven movie, but the interesting subversion, I guess, and their little play on the genre is that like they're not like, oh, we were tough guys and we're out of it now and we're getting back into for a loyal cause. It's like, no, let's go commit some war crimes and have some fun and high five each other. But like I think the first time I saw this movie, the thing that like confused me and I had to live with for a long time before I saw a couple more times and then actually worked it out of my head is who's the main character in this movie? There kind of isn't one, because it is two or three movies stuck together. And, you know, as tired as it can feel when you see those chapter one, chapter two things from Tarantino, which are in so many of his movies, in this movie, it really that's the only time you can ever take a breath is you're like, oh my God, there's another chapter of this movie. Or you're like, oh my God, I forgot about the first chapter. We're going to come back to that now. But it's like, you watch the movie, you watch the movie with Landa, And then you watch a movie with Brad Pitt and you're like, these are two very different World War II movies about two very different groups that I'm both kind of cool with rooting for. And then when they come together at the end, it's like, you never see the Magnificent Seven going up against the Nazis. Like, that's not how that works.
Oh,
but then you put those two together
super,
and it's like,
that's super interesting. Yeah.
You got your dumb mountain man who's the leader of his movie versus the super smart Nazi guy, the leader of his movie, and you put them in a scene together and you're like, this looks really weird when these two guys are side by side, but they're both sitting across that table from each other making faces like, yeah, you kind of got me, but, you know, I'm still going to do my thing.
And not like, long after that, that's the biggest switcheroo, which is, wow, this has turned into fantasy. This is, you know, I'm curious when you guys think that, like, when you were watching it for the first time, I don't know if you guys knew that this was a, you know, a fantasy historical epic.
No.
Oh, like the moment when you realized
what's
this,
the point?
Yeah,
yeah,
right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And for me, it was literally, you know, Hitler getting the shit blown out of him with the machine gun. And I'm like, okay, that's this kind of, it just turned into a new kind of movie right now.
You're like, wait a minute. I thought I missed a day in social studies where there was an attempted assassination in a movie theater.
Right.
But no, apparently we're down another path.
But there's a lot of fun being had with that. I mean, like, I learned this from the IMDb trivia page. One of the names on the Jew Bears, the Bear Jew, Jew? Mm-hmm. How do you say that? How do you pronounce that?
Eli Roth.
That right?
It's Bear Jew.
Eli Roth's bat, one of the names is Anne Frank. And there's no way, I mean, at that point, what was this? This is June of 44. You know, I don't think she was even in a camp yet, so.
Yeah.
Let alone famous, but that's okay, because that's part of this bigger movie. But yeah, I'm thinking like you got a war movie, you got a Western, you got a spy movie, you got a heist movie, you got a couple different kinds of war movies. You know what I mean? There's mm-hmm. so much going on. I mean, like in some ways, Shoshana is in a spy movie, right?
Very you know, much so, yeah.
Sort of. I mean, I'm not sure. What would you call the genre that, I mean, it's a silly exercise, but there are different things going on. It's not one thing. In some ways, it's a little bit of a noir, maybe, you know, a little
yeah.
bit.
Yeah. Can we talk about how that move the propaganda movie within the movie?
Now, there's a story behind that.
That seems like such an unwatchable film.
Yeah, but they were really digging it.
Yeah, they were.
Yeah.
I mean, my knowledge of German propaganda films at the time is pretty slim. So
oh, you're kidding. Oh, God, I'm going to change your life tonight. After, when we're done recording, I'm going to ruin the rest of your life by sending you to archive.org for some really, really unbearable movies.
Other than the Riefenstahl type stuff, but I'm
no,
talking about like
are you
war
kidding me?
Films.
Oh, that's like Trekker Speed. I'm talking about the serious product. I'm talking about, oh, my God. There are some very, very disturbing propaganda movies. Oh. So the story goes, according to IMDb, which is never wrong, Eli Roth directed the movie, the film within a film.
Ah, so that's why it's unwatchable.
Easy Tex. What do you hear? Hey, you ever, do you take credit for the final quality of every movie you work on?
No.
Is that a thing you do? Like that Watchmen. How's that Watchmen movie? How's that doing?
Ouch. No,
oh, comma.
You didn't even go for the low-hanging fruit.
What, is that a Transformer? I'm like, which one should I be eating?
Hey, Smurfs are the lowest hanging fruit there is. They're three apples high.
I'm walking
Smurfs are
here.
Three apples high, yeah.
Quentin Tarantino asked Roth to direct the short. Da-da-da-da joined him. Okay, so listen to this. For you guys in your Hollywood work ethic, ask his brother Gabriel Roth to join him to direct behind a second camera. In 2 days, the brothers got 130 camera setups, and Tarantino was so pleased he gave Roth a third day that he was originally planning to shoot. He got 50 more setups the third day, much to Tarantino's delight. Total running time of the Roth's movie is 5 minutes and 30 seconds. But
he got 32 setups on the third day, and on the fourth day, they left the city. Isn't that how it goes?
I think then they invented the fish. Then God made original sin. I think it's in Leviticus. But I think it really nailed God. And how great were the reaction shots by Hitler and who's the other guy? Who's the weasel guy?
Goebbels.
Propaganda guy.
Yeah.
Goebbels? Yeah, Goebbels.
Yep.
But yeah, really it does. You got to see some of these movies. They are
all right.
You didn't see the freeing of the camps movies? You haven't seen those?
The freeing of the camps movies, no.
Have him back. We're gonna have a super fun episode.
This seems problematic and we haven't even started talking about it.
They make the villagers. They make the villagers walk the Americans and the Russians make the villagers walk through the camp they forced them with handkerchiefs over their nose, forced them to walk through the camp and see everything that was going on yards from their house.
Yeah, my visit to Dachau was pretty wrenching, and hearing those stories about the folks in that lived around the camp. It's like, oh yeah.
Yeah.
The Americans did not let them off the hook after the liberation. And
no, they made them dig. Hey, this is fun, you guys.
Yeah.
So
how about
anyway,
the cinematography? Let's talk about cinematography now.
You got lenses, you got lights.
I got a cinematography thing if you want to turn.
Please, get it going, because I want to talk.
One thing that I first noticed in Django, which is in this movie that's about sitting around tables, that he does a couple of times in a couple of his movies, is he loves to put an overhead light over a table and almost blow out all of the highlights on the table, so you can't even see what's going on. But that sort of works as like a natural bounce key on all of the characters to create this weird sort of like ghosty look, but also they're falling off into darkness the further away they lean from the table. And it's you don't see a lot of people who are like, I totally don't mind if you just like can't see what's going on with their hands on the table. That's not relevant at all. It's all about this sort of hazy light that's bouncing onto their faces.
Now, I think this is the first film that Robert Richardson shot with Tarantino. I think Tarantino used other cinematographers. I might be wrong about that, but that's a signature style of Robert Richardson, who I consider to be one of the great American cinematographers working today. I hope he's American. I somebody Google it and don't at me.
Let's check IMDb.
That is one of please do. That's one of his signature styles, to just completely blasting overhead. Maybe you get some halo rim light, and then let the table, let the papers, let all of that bounce up and hit the actors. And like his films are, he did a lot of Oliver Stone's movies, like JFK and The Doors was shot that way. I find it to be really, I mean, it's unique, for lack of a better term. You don't see a lot of movies shot that way. And once you start intellectualizing it, you're like, this is utterly ridiculous.
you got a $100 million movie. How are we going to light this? We'll put a big light right in the middle there and point it straight down. Cool. Great. Right. That sounds awesome.
And
that'll give us a lot of flexibility.
If you really think, I mean, they shot it Hateful Eight in a similar way, and you have a cabin at night, and that similar style, you know, continued. You don't want to think about it too much. But I just adored how that was done. For this movie, just to, like when somebody's shuffling around papers and all of a sudden you get this crazy the bounce come back up, or Shoshana's red dress near the end of the movie when she walks through one of those spotlights, it reflects the red just all over the set.
Wow.
For just a brief moment, it's just like a splash of color. Not a lot of people do that.
I got a question, since you brought up the end of the movie and that red dress scene. There's that beautiful dissolve of zooming in on her in that big round window, but then she walks out of that room and the camera goes over the walls. Do you love cameras moving through surfaces that are not supposed to?
He was channeling a little too much De Palma there. I mean, that's just sometimes when the indulgence goes a little bit too far. Yeah,
that's a shot from Kill Bill 1 that has been dumbed way down. The shot is 9 minutes long in Kill Bill, and he did it for like 10 seconds in this movie.
That's
so
a great shot.
Right.
But why do the junior version? That's my question.
I thought in general, I don't know. I'm not a super close student of these things, and I'm not the Karma Suck Joe is, but the whole like lobby of the theater, it was a little chintzy, a little bit.
The design of it, or just the staging? What are you talking about?
No, just the implementation of the design. It felt a little bit like a set, and maybe that was part of the idea. I didn't mind that. It needed to show, you know, that motion. Also, real-time follow-up, copyright John Syracuse, 2011. Robert Richardson is from Massachusetts.
Gotcha. Okay.
And his first films for Tarantino were Kill Bill 1 and 2.
There you go. And it's beautifully shot.
Huh. Oh, he did Shutter Island. Oh, that's a good movie.
Yeah. This guy, you know, look at his... The Doors is, oh man, love how the movie is shot.
In his IMDb photo, he's wearing sunglasses and looking at the ground with a pensive look on his face, and he has long hair blowing in the wind. So
it's like if Alan Moore and Miyazaki had a baby. That is not a baby I would want to sit.
Oh.
Who also rings. Is a slave to film. as a medium.
It yeah.
has to be film.
He wrote the comic book Watchmen, just so you know.
Oh, boy.
Miyazaki. He did Wall Street. He was the director of photography. Look at that. This guy's done some great stuff. Nixon.
Wag the Dog. That's a good one.
Wag the Dog. Eat, Pray, Love. Mm-hmm. Pick two. Mm-hmm.
This has been...
That's called...
reading
life management. The Life Management Triangle. Eat, Pray,
we'll
Love.
Right
pick
back.
Two.
We'll be right back with reading IMDb after this message from Squarespace.
In color.
Rated
yeah,
R.
Can you believe they didn't even have an intermission in this Nazi
now
propaganda film?
Ah, sickening.
We need the what's the French song for the let's all go to the lobby and have ourselves a snack? I'm sure they have one, right?
A la lobby.
It's just a dancing bottle of wine and a bag.
Yeah, and then the German meth comes in and just knocks it over.
Mm-hmm.
The milk.
Come yeah, well, milk. I going back to what you were saying about the theater lobby. Yeah, it's a little flatly lit. It feels a little underwhelming. The camera is moving around very freely through the space. There's just a lot of people and banners, and that's it. The lobby is lit much better in an earlier scene where Shoshana is talking to Marcel.
I'm thinking of when the two guys run up the steps. I was taken a little bit out of the movie when they were doing that. I just thought, I don't know why I'm mentioning this, but that so much of it, I was really in the movie, but I mean, you know, just, and then just, there's so many little ticks and tricks and, like, you know, gonna go deliver the champagne with the gun wristband. I mean, like, there's just so much wackadoodle in this.
I do like, there's little, okay, so a couple of things. The lobby, there's a lot of, like, virtuoso, like, big camera crane shots in that sequence. And I think it starts with a big oneer. You follow different characters and then the camera cranes to another character and they move and do their thing and then it follows another character. So there's an artifice, the subconscious artifice that comes from seeing a move like that. Following characters running upstairs in a movie that's shot pretty naturalistically other than, you know, an occasional De Palma looking down type shot. They can throw you out. I just remembered one of those shots of the two bastards running up the stairs when they leave the theater and they're going upstairs. You can see the dynamite explosive still on their legs. I just thought that was a nice little touch.
You're kidding me? It's Tarantino. He's going to do all this stuff practically. That's his thing.
Practical.
Well, you know what I mean. He's going to make everyone do the thing as awkwardly as it could possibly be.
CGI dynamite is ruining movies.
Yeah. Actually, do you guys know anything about the visual effects of this movie?
John Dykstra was the VFX supervisor.
Yeah.
Wow.
But do you know, like, to what extent any of the work? I have a feeling this is one of those films where I couldn't find anything in my 5 seconds of research. And I have a feeling this is one of those movies where it's like, nope, nobody's going to be talking publicly about the visual effects of this movie.
Oh, yeah. No,
if anything, it's
happen.
Probably one of those very boring, like, drive stories. Like, just make more gore and blood when everyone explodes and splatters everywhere. But I feel like there had to be something in the projecting of the face and the smoke stuff.
Right. Yeah, 90% of this was probably fixing wig lines. But, you know, this is just something you assume these days. But
speaking of effects, the makeup effects and the squibs and the blood and everything like that, that's all the Walking Dead folks, the KNB effects group. One of the nice bits of craft I liked at the one of the last shots of the movie is the carving of the swastika into Waltz's forehead. It starts on a, you know, the gut wrenching close up of just his forehead and the movement of the knife going in. I think that stuff is very well done, work. And, you know, you're immediately, your brain goes to, even non, you know, experts think, oh, okay, this is a prosthetic of some kind, probably a complete dummy head. And the camera in an uninterrupted, zooms out so you could see, Waltz's eyes. And I just thought that's a nice little switcheroo. It's like you think you're seeing one thing and it's like, nope, we're going to just show you his forehead. And from that angle, it's still a prosthetic.
Did they really? I feel like I remember that being a little bit more of a, like, Rick Baker looking forehead.
I loved it. I thought it was really great. I looked for a seam a little bit, but the motion of the knife and the way the blood came out, I thought that worked really well.
Mm-hmm.
I probably wasn't watching in every little detail intensely, going over every pore, as they say. But I mean, it's fine. There's a lot of stuff where people blow up. They're like, one of the more dramatic squibs, of course, is when Zoller and Shoshana shoot one another up in the projectionist booth, and there's that slow motion like fiber and blood and stuff just falling in the air, in the dust, in the projectionist booth. So that was interesting in that it wasn't just a simple squib, like, oh look, there's some blood, and then she falls over. But
surprise ending, she's full of confetti. Yeah.
That was dramatic for dramatic sake. Like, I think one of my other favorite ones in this, it's so fast that it's almost comical, is when they're rescuing Stiglitz out of his little pen there, and they're all the Nazis are just sort of sitting there reading their newspaper, and Eli Roth pops out from behind a corner just like super fast, and he has a shotgun and blasts the guy in the chest, and he goes flying out a window, basically.
Love that.
Just explodes everywhere.
I mean, this was done to a much greater extent in Django Unchained, but you saw little glimpses of it, like when after a squib fires,
flying out of frame.
Yeah, right. the blood mist that hangs out in the air long after the squib has gone off. I actually really like that. It's, and then the whole
it's an aphrodisiac to Tarantino.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just coke feet and blood squibs.
Coke feet and squib spray.
He creates a nice red halo atmosphere in his home to get in the mood for things.
Yeah, Uma, let's do seven more for coverage. If you know what I mean.
I like your impression. That's good.
That's Randy from Pee Wee.
Close enough.
Hey, Pee Wee. Ice cream soup.
Now, we've skipped around a bit, but is there...
We had fun, but, really? You know...
Is there anything in particular that we haven't really... Like, we've talked about tension, we've talked about building up the different movie events throughout this, different genres, and assembling it in this way. We've brought up all the different casting that's here. I mean, I feel like there's way more stuff to talk about, mm-hmm. but I just don't even know where to begin. It just seems like an
well,
endless
I have
pile.
I have a quotidian plot query. Mm-hmm. How do we feel about the scene we all obviously love, where he brings the office guy and Brad Pitt into the office, and then there's a sudden change of character, apparently. This is a boring plot thing. There's no squibs and feet in this, but how do we feel about that scene? Where he has a plan. Like, was that his plan all along? Does that color how we feel? I'm sorry, I'm being unnecessarily obtuse. There's a scene where he calls in these two guys that he might as well kill and says, look, make me a deal. Get on that phone, make me a deal. Here's what I want, and we'll make this all go away. So, like, but he also, there's the implication that maybe he's not the Jew hunter. Maybe that was just there for branding reasons. Mm-hmm. I think there's a lot to unpack in that scene from a plot standpoint. I'm still processing that. What do you guys think about that scene?
Well, in character, because you're like, you don't expect the big bad guy to, you know, all of a sudden question his devotion to.
No, it's like the Joker, it's like the Joker negotiating for nicer pillows at Arkham before he turns himself in. It seems it's a very strange, or at least unexpected twist to that character and the story.
Yeah. I mean, doesn't he show a certain amount of like, I'm an investigator. I want to learn things. I want to find people. I find people. That's my job. And he didn't necessarily show a lot of devotion, outward devotion to the Third Reich and to the Nazi Party. But it is terribly surprising for him to see, wow, this is an opportunity for me to create a post-war life. And maybe he's gamed this out. He's thought this through. Maybe he knew he could see the writing on the wall, like the Germans were not going to win and I need to have an exit plan. Maybe he's been trotting out exit plans all the while.
to everybody that he captures.
Yeah. Prequel idea. I find that fascinating. It's like, okay, everything we figured out, everything we've been shown, has kind of been turned on its head. And he's trying to make a deal here. And it is good. That's good. I'll take that deal. You know, it's really cool.
I'm kind of skeptical about the sudden turn because we don't see anything that sort of precipitates this inside of the film. Right. He doesn't express any doubts up to this point. He had just recently killed Von Hammersmark very brutally by strangling her. So it's and he is still ready to go ahead and give these people up. It has nothing to do with principle, and it has to do with getting out of this. But you could make the argument that he sees the writing on the wall, but there's nothing in the film that shows that he's sure. thinking about the writing
exactly.
on the wall.
Exactly. I mean, like, if this were a movie about what happened in history in the 40s, we would know that this was actually one of the two or three times that were just a huge inflection point in like how the war was going to go. The Americans were well and truly in, mm-hmm. the tide had turned, we were past Midway. There's all kinds of things that were like going like, oh, you know, the whole thing in Russia not going so great. There's a lot of stuff that anybody in the know getting intel would know that things aren't going great. But I agree with you, that was not on the screen. It felt not like a betrayal of country or mm-hmm. cause. It felt more like a much more personal, like, you know, yes. The jackal is ready to get out of the business at this point for some reason. Like, this is my retirement.
Well, I think they found Shoshana.
Yes. I think there was one moment on the screen that they're trying to lead you to this decision. The reason Hitler decides to go to the premiere is he mentions, you know, the Americans are on the beach and he's done a great service for our country. So I think me being there would be a good morale booster for people. So they kind of say, like, you know, Hitler's a little bummed out because they're kind of getting their butts kicked. And that's why he decides to go be part of this propaganda, you know, film premiere thing. But I think another part of it is potentially that, you know, he figures out from analyzing the basement that something went wrong here with a plan. And then luckily he's able to get ahead of it. But I think there's a little bit of a respect that he has for Brad Pitt and saying, like, you got all the way here. Like, you're in the room with Hitler with dynamite strapped to your leg. That's pretty impressive. Like, I, you know, at some point somebody's going to come along and be smart enough to get there. And right. of course, yeah, he's definitely going to be a smart enough guy to have his out, you know, as soon as he can possibly find one, he's going to have an exit strategy. But I think part of it's like, you know, they're not necessarily equals because he feels like he got the better of Brad Pitt, although he kind of didn't at the very end. But he's just like, you know what, this is my opportunity. We're going to lose. I'm going to get out of here. And, you know, we're on the same playing field because you're a great American soldier, and I'm, you know, clearly you should respect me for what I did for my side, and let's shake hands and part ways, and, you know, you can help me out here.
So why did he help? Why did he, because, like, maybe I'm remembering wrong, like, he has, so there's the kind of these two unconscious, there's these two different plots to make this thing happen this night, right? And he ends up being the linchpin in one part of it. He finds the dynamite with the timer and goes, oh, clever. And then as we see in the little, like, you know, roll this back flashback, like, he was directly responsible, right, for the dynamite that killed Hitler.
Yep.
Well, yes, so, but I mean,
Hitler that? Had already been shot in the face, and there was also dynamite strapped to both the legs of the guys. But yeah, like, it was one more, like, well, I'll help out too kind of moment.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think it was one of those instances where he just kind of figured, like, you know, they're here. They have this opportunity. Like, they got all the way here before we even got a whiff of their plan. And I should probably, you know, if it's not this plan that's going to take him out, it's going to be the next one in a couple of weeks, whatever, because we're clearly losing our stronghold.
Oh, so it's more like he recognized talent.
Basically, yeah. I said, you know, these guys are probably going to take the lead here shortly. So let me see if I can get in their good graces and mm-hmm. sort of use them to my advantage, I guess, buy a house on Nantucket Island.
Very specific.
Nantucket Island.
Should have aimed for the West Coast.
Wake up, Joe.
Hey, buddy.
Yeah, hi. I don't know. I just
you don't have to like it, man. Come on. It's okay.
It's fine. But yeah.
Defend your position, Joe. Defend your position.
Yeah, it just doesn't completely jive with everything that he's been up to.
The story goes, according to IMDb, which is never wrong, that he, when you say he spent 10 years working on it, it might have started on a cocktail napkin while he was tracing Uma Thurman's feet, but he worked on this for a long time.
Do you think she kissed it and then handed it off and says, love, right.
Take my shoe, put this in your fancy leather coat. But he's the story goes that he worked on this for a long time, just not knowing, you know, what the end would be. And I have to tell you, I've seen this movie, parts of it. God, Syracuse would kill me. This is this last time that I've watched it has been in like four different weird parts. Mm. Where like I had like, you know, I think we started talking about this because I gone back and started from the beginning. And, you know, we haven't talked a lot about it, but the opening sequence of this movie is masterful. It's, I think, like it's, it reminds me so much of like what, who's the Wheat and Thunder guy? Malick? It's got a little bit of Malick. Yeah. It's got some John Ford. There's so much going on in that opening sequence.
Got some Hitchcock. You got the literal bomb under, or almost literal bomb underneath the table.
Yeah. I mean, there's so much going on.
Underneath the table.
It's utterly assured. It is unbelievably tense. You know, hats off to the dairy actor. That guy's just amazing. Mm-hmm. But I've watched this in kind of a fractured way. And then in my usual panic to cram last night, I watched the third act. I thought, you know, wherever I left off on iTunes, I'll jump back in. Starting around the interrogation of the actress scene. You know, take the slug out of your gam scene. And I watched to the end and I was like, I should really go to bed. And I ended up rewinding way back and watching the second act. So I haven't watched the first act as carefully in the last few nights, but like it's, I don't know. It really strikes me that it weirdly does hang together as a crazy genre mashup. And I don't know. I don't know. I don't have anything profound to say. I feel like it's one of the best Tarantino movies as a movie and as a Tarantino movie. And like, I think he finally got everything lined up to make the high budget fan fiction that he'd always wanted to make.
I agree with that assessment.
Yeah. I can't say it any better than that.
Yeah, you probably could.
He was able to put his ego aside for a little bit and like let some scenes actually play out with characters without trying to do crazy nonsense.
Some of the
nonsense.
Shots, the breathing. One reason, if you want to have great reaction gifs out of your video, like you have to have time to breathe. There has to be time to like let it keep running, get that reaction shot, get the eye roll, and you know that was there in this one. What do you think, Todd?
I just keep thinking back to. You know, when you look at the path of filmmakers and once they've directed five or six films, you can kind of see an arc of where they're going. Are they still progressing as artists? Are they branching out? Are they exploring different genres, or are they remaking the same film over and over again, which isn't a terrible thing. That's not a bad thing to keep hammering on a similar theme or a similar motif throughout their careers. And one of the things I just really admired about this movie is that it's like, it, like I probably said earlier, is that he grew up. He made a grown-up movie. He didn't just make the movie he wanted to make if Lee Marvin was still alive, you know, just to keep making those over and over again. And, I see a progression. I admire the craft. But there was something about this from beginning to end, add to the visuals, the staging, his use of music has always been impeccable. But all of those moments, letting moments
finding
breathe.
A way to work in a David Bowie song.
Right. Right. I think a great achievement. And, I was so excited to get to watch this again from beginning to end in a single sitting as one is supposed to do with films.
Well, which TV did you watch it on?
The big LCD in our.
Oh, LCD, not a plasma.
No, not a plasma.
Oh, well, sad. Yeah. Not good. Mm-hmm. Did you have the motion smoothing on?
Yeah, I got to have it on. I mean, I want it to look like a window to the world, you know?
This looks like a movie.
You have plenty of reflected light on it. I would agree this is a grown-up film. Like, it has character and depth to it in ways that I don't think many of his other productions tend to do, and I enjoy it unreservedly, Like, even all the little things that I said, like, I still thought this was a good thing. I'm happy I saw it. I should have seen it sooner, and I shouldn't have been so reluctant to partake in the Tarantino experience.
That's high praise.
But you have seen, Django and Hateful Eight?
I've seen Django. I haven't seen Hateful Eight. That's mm-hmm. another one I'm still reluctant about, just because of the, mm-hmm. oh, you have to watch it on the original celluloid film thing. We're touring the country. And I was just like, nope, I can't hop on this pretension train.
God, well, the roadshow was in your town like 3 days ago.
Yeah.
Yeah. I tried Hateful Eight, and it was a Batman v Superman for me, where, like, no matter where I was in the movie, it felt like there was still 2 more hours left.
Yeah.
Like, it just went on. Is it worth watching to the end?
Yes, and I like it for different reasons than I do Inglourious Basterds. It is tough to watch any movie, even with the most fantastically cool characters, and which maybe Hateful Eight has a few, that takes place in a room mm-hmm. the whole time. I mean, there's just limitations to that, and maybe it
felt like a play.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
And, but, you know, I love the cast. I love the way it was shot. I think it's pretty gorgeous. I think the same lenses were used on that were used on Rogue One.
Yes.
Oh, thank you, Dan. Thank you.
You're correct.
Talking out of my butt there.
Ultra Panavision 70, man.
Yeah, yeah.
Boom.
It's the best way to do it. You can get really close to people and still see stuff I believe the way they touted it. And they had some cool looking flares.
That's the tagline.
Mm-hmm.
Still see stuff.
They're just going to have to run with that.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree. Hateful Eight is a good one to check out. It is constrained by the limitations of being 2+ hours in a single room, but there's some great character stuff in there, and it's fun. I even enjoyed it. I was one of the jerks on the internet who read the script when it got leaked, and the modified version that I watched in the movie theater there was still quite enjoyable.
Yeah.
Okay, fine. Maybe I'll go watch it.
Yeah, you should do that.
I should watch half of it. That's what I'm going to do.
Well, there is an intermission, so you can pause halfway through if you want.
I'll watch half up to before the intermission. So
I'm also collecting a list of various Holocaust films that we can discuss next time we get together. I will circulate that to you guys. Give you time to watch the first and second half of The Eternal Jew, Night Will Fall. I'll put all these together for the Google Doc.
Mm. We do enjoy our time together, don't we?
Oh, we have fun, don't we?
Oh, boy. I misspoke the name of
this. Put it in the can. You're done. Yep. You killed it. Done. Boom. Dunzo.
Sure. Shut it down. There we go. It's really hot in here.
Joe, are you happy?
I'm content enough, I think.
Oh my gosh!
I always really get uncomfortable. I get uncomfortable when Joe is, you know, I just expect him to be unhappy about the movie and sigh, and like I worry. Like La La Land, I have a very specific recollection of listening to you guys talking about La La Land while I was waiting to pick up my kid. I kept waiting for Joe to be very unhappy about it.
I was expecting to be unhappy about that.
Always a reason with you. Always a reason. I know. Go ahead. You always got a reason.
I thought I would be unhappy about it. Just because everybody, this is when everybody had pooped on it after it had been something everybody should see.
Oh, so you got the double turns out backlash.
Yeah, yeah. So then I was like, oh, this isn't actually that bad. And I enjoyed it.
There could be much can be said about seeing a movie in a vacuum forget about full media blackout. I'm even going beyond that, because once you hear anybody say you have to see this movie or this is getting raves, it's automatically changes. Yes, it changes the way you're going to look at something.
No, you've changed my thinking about this. For me, this all, like, my canonical example of this was, like, everybody's got movies like this, like these special dumb movies. Like in my case, like, it was like after the family had gone to sleep, I would like slip out and like watch a movie on HBO or Showtime, like circa 1981, 82. And I remember I'm flipping on the TV and Escape from New York came on. And I didn't know anything about it. It's not a great movie, but it's such a great movie. It's like one of those movies where, like, if you don't know anything about this and you're 13, this is the greatest thing that you've ever seen.
Yeah.
And like, there's those movies, and like, there's so many movies. Another movie, another Brad Pitt movie, Seven. I knew nothing about Seven.
Yep.
I just showed up in the theater, and like, my eyes were agog the entire time. There's just something so special about like being able to go into a movie knowing what the title, the star, the rating, and just like getting to see it on its own terms. And there's probably like the ratio is like 1 to 7 of movies where like, I wish I could have gone into this knowing nothing about it. I bet I would have had a completely different impression of the movie. Really knowing zero, no trailers. Because these fucking trailers, I mean, it's just like nobody writes a good third act anymore, and yet the entire third act is like in the trailer, and you're like, wow.
We've been playing the Arrival soundtrack around the house. We play a lot of soundtracks, and that's admittedly that's a weird one to be playing. It's not very melodic.
No,
but you know I had it on, and the 5-year-old was like, "I love the drums," so we play it a lot. And so they see the cover art and they ask me, "What's the movie about?" They see the spaceship, the oblong, you know, looking spaceship. So I showed my 9-year-old the trailers. I'm not going to show her the movie yet.
Really,
Merlin,
what did she think?
Merlin, you showed it to your daughter, right?
She wakes up on Saturdays and watches it. She loves it. Yeah.
The thing is
when we saw, you know, the first, you know, bit of Arrival is tough.
Yeah.
For anybody, especially a little kid. But I was like, I did my dumb thing where I was like, you know, it'll be fine. Stay with it.
Well, I wanted to show her the trailers, and
it is a good nerd movie, and it's right on the edge for a tween.
Fantastic movie. And I went into that one full media blackout. I didn't know anything about it going in, and I had never seen the trailer. So sitting down the other night, we sat down and we watched all the trailers, and I was like, as is almost always the case, holy crap, they just outlined the movie.
I know.
There's no mystery. And every once in a while you'll get a trailer company or a filmmaker who actually has control over, you know, the promotion of the film, who takes their time and gives you a literal tease, a little bit of a taste, a little bit of a character, a thread of something, not a summary of the movie. Here's the first act of the trailer, here's the second act of the trailer, and then here's the third. I mean, they're just mirroring the arcs of the film.
It's so frustrating. Like what's Antony's movie? Is it Atomic Blonde? Is that what it's called?
Yeah, based on The Coldest Winter.
Right, but I mean, like that one, like to me, oh, God, I love that trailer. And it walks right up to the line because you're like, oh, okay, there's like a spy lady who kicks butt and her former lover has died. But like, I don't know what happens in that movie. I know that at some point there's things involving pulleys and jumping out of windows. But like, I don't know what's happening. But I'm totally pumped for that movie. And that's why in some ways I feel like teaser trailers, I feel like there was one of those for Guardians of the Galaxy that was really good.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there's those ones where like teaser trailers in some ways are the best because they don't have enough footage to fuck it up. Like go back and watch the trailers for Star Wars. They are a riot. A New Hope. The 1977 movie. You go back and watch those, and they were still working out the brand. I mean, Todd, you know this better than me, but like you go back and watch those, and the voiceover is so silly, and it's all so ridiculous. But you come out of it like so jacked for like whatever this is going to be, even though it's just a bunch of incomplete, like practically production stills.
Did Princess Leia walk towards the TIE fighter? Was that in the trailer?
Yeah, she was. Walked right toward, and yet she was dressed as Darth Vader.
Oh.
They left it out of the movie.
They caught it
on a lunch break. It looked like a cool setup. So they just, you know, while we're here.
Yeah, she was doing a bump, and she.
Todd just taking a sip of his beverage.
Yeah, I like teasers. As long as they're teasers, there's a lot of times these days where it's like, this is the teaser for our pre-teaser that'll be coming out Tuesday. Make sure you tune in tomorrow to actually catch the teaser. And then you watch this stuff and it's just like a regular trailer. It's not even a teaser. It's just like, this is their first trailer. So are you going to call it a teaser? And I don't greatly enjoy those. Like the build up to Jurassic World, there were 50,000 versions of whatever that sea thing was that jumped up in the air. And you saw every single moment of that. And that's the only interesting thing about that sea thing that jumped up in the air. And it was in every teaser trailer and trailer that went before the film. So no like, wonder and delight.
There's so many different genres of, we should probably go to bed, but there's so many different genres of trailer types. There's this one, I've mentioned this on other programs, but there's the one about where the woman wants to figure out her legacy and she hires the woman who's going to write her biography, and it's the Shirley MacLaine movie. And like, have you seen that trailer? It's just, I go to a lot of movies. So I've seen a lot of terrible trailers. And it's one of those ones where it's like, okay, doop de doop de doo, basic setup, beebada doobada dee, second act stuff develops. And then the third act, the violins and the cellos are playing. And you're like, fucking A. Now she's a DJ at like an independent jazz station.
Oh my God, I saw that.
You saw that. And she wants to now like earn her obituary. And my daughter and I, like, we basically, this is a bit, we'll turn to each other and both go, hard pass, is the thing we say to each other. And we're like, no, we're both like, hard pass. Like, this looks, and the trailer is too long, and you're sad, and you know the whole movie. But like, you know, if I apply the, as we discussed earlier on the internet today, the Ebert standard, like the Ebert standard applied to like, say, Thor Ragnarok. You know what? Two thumbs up. Like, because that one, it's like, it did everything it needed to do. Jacked.
You mean the second Thor movie?
Or... yes, because, well, there is no second Thor movie. The third Thor movie.
Was there a first one?
Oh, man. Wow.
Wow, Todd is cold.
This Thor 3 trailer, I thought, was totally awesome.
Well, and here's why, and I say it, because it had some defocused, like Joe Steele style graphics, like to do some 80s drive style titles, like so fun. And like, it was so anarchic, and like, he does get tied up kind of a lot, which was sort of weird. But like, the whole trailer, like, just telegraphed the entire bananas nature of this. This is going to be a fun Ant-Man Guardian style movie. And then you bring in the Hulk, and he's got the funny line about a guy. And like, that's a trailer where I watch that and I go, that did this utterly functioned at what it needs to do. I have a feeling this movie will be as fun as this trailer, and I'm excited to see it. Like that to me, like by Ebert standards, is a very, well, I have to see the movie to know, but like, very successful.
Before Thumbs I let up. You go, Dan, do you want to talk about how much you love Marvel movies and things that look like Guardians of the Galaxy?
I wasn't going to go Guardians right away, but I was going to say, did you notice our guy in Inglourious Basterds, Zoller there? He was in Captain America Civil War. He was a bad guy.
Yeah, he's Baron Munchausen. Oh, shit.
Yeah, he is Baron Munchausen. You're right.
I forgot about that because in my memory,
shit,
Captain America
totally
Civil War.
I missed that.
So Civil
that guy,
War is
a
movie
is a
where
total
some people
cuck.
Punch each other.
Total fucking cuck. What?
Oh, jeez.
Oh, my gosh. There's so many levels to this movie. Have us, Todd.
Yes.
Order more wine and come back. We should do more of these programs. We have so much to discuss here.
Stay tuned for.
We need an
two.
Epilogue for Inglourious Basterds where they restore the dictator to health, and then we can have this guy in there.
Oh, yeah.
He's in like a Hydra cryo tube or something
incident,
with a bunch of blue
that
fluid.
That incident historically would be if Hitler had survived the premiere of the film, it would be about a month later.
Hmm.
I just
imagine him when he's slamming his fist against the table going 99999, you know, and he's sweating. I'm like, I wonder what he's on right now.
The bar is in the globe.
And that's such a Tarantino line. If you were to offer me a scotch and water, I would drink a scotch and plain water.
Oh, like, wait, shit, dog. We never talked about fucking Mike Myers. So you feel distracted, Todd?
Yeah. I mean, if you don't know who Mike Myers is, then the scene plays fine. Mm. But
is he the making copies guy? Is that who he is?
Yeah.
No, that's the other one.
Leatherman?
Massive Head Wound Harry. That's who it was.
Oh, God, the 90s. Am I right?
Is the one who got famous for falling down the stairs on SNL?
Get this.
Did you know that it was the 20th anniversary of Austin Powers?
Oof. What?
Yeah. Oof. May.
No. This is the 20th anniversary of the year that didn't happen. So that's like 20 years of Radiohead, of the OK Computer. What else happened in 97? Yeah. 1997.
Titanic? Starship Troopers?
That's later. That's later.
1997.
No.
1997.